Well, thank you very much, Dr. Moeller. It's a great honor to be here and to speak. Before I read my text, which incidentally has been changed, and if you want a good reason why I've changed my text, the introduction that goes with the text that's printed in the bulletin takes about 15 minutes longer, and I can give you a shorter introduction with the text that I'm going to use. I got to touch a couple of bases, though. First of all, I hope you'll all take out a pen and use the bulletin, because I would like you to draw a picture or two during the message. Now, I know this is not Sunday school, but this normally when I give this message, I have access to a screen and an overhead projector, and so I'm going to ask you to sort of perform that function yourself. Secondly, I want to give you all a free gift. Wow. Yes, it's an internet site. Let me give you the address, and since you've got your pen out, you can write down the address for this internet site. It's www. Now, I know that's hard to remember, but try www.biblicaltraining.org. Let me tell you what you'll find on that site. And I tell you not so much that you need something else to do in your spare time, but many of you no doubt have friends or relatives who could take great advantage of this. Dr. Bill Maus, who's one of the great Greek teachers in the history of the church, has started this home site in order to give access to people all over the world, access to complete audio tapes of various seminary courses. I've got three or four courses on that. Other Southern professors have courses that are coming online. And you can listen to these tapes free of charge. Eventually, those tapes will be available in other languages, the major languages of the world, and I suppose there'll also be some videotapes that go with that. Now, there's an interesting consequence with this home site. For those of you who are interested in eschatology, and why should you not be, this is the week in which the 11th volume of the Left Behind series appears, all right? The 11th volume. I'm not going to buy the first one until the 53rd volume appears. But anyway, one of the great mysteries of dispensational theology is how so many people become believers after the church is gone. You know, the rapture of the church occurs, and all of the Christians are gone, and the Holy Spirit is gone, and the church is gone, and yet you get this large number of people who become Christians. And I think the answer to the question must be my tapes, all right? Plus the tapes of the other Southern professors who will be on that internet site as well. Those of you who are interested in books that contain this particular message, parts of this message in various forms appear in my book, Life's Ultimate Questions, Worldviews in Conflict, and also Faith and Reason. For those of you who are Koreans, I just got an email yesterday that told me that the Korean translation of my book, Faith and Reason, is now available in Korea. Probably take a few more weeks to get to this country. But I'm pleased about that. I suppose of all of the languages in which my books have been translated, the translations in Korean mean the most to me. Maybe that's because there are more Calvinists in South Korea than there are in lots of other places in the world. Now, I've changed my text. I'm going to read from Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. And I'm going to pick up in the middle of a sentence, and you shouldn't do that. That if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus... An alternate translation is that if thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus as Lord, and shalt believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. It was 12 years ago, this week, I was in my last few months in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I had announced my retirement from Western Kentucky University. I retired 12 years ago? But I don't look like I'm 80 years old, do I? So I guess that's how we could explain that. I got a phone call from a fellow named Stan Oakes, a longtime friend. And Stanley said, Ron, are you interested in going to the Soviet Union? This was the spring of 1991. I said, what would I do in the Soviet Union? Stan says, God's doing a miracle. The Soviet Department of Education is going to pay hundreds of people to come and hear you speak about the differences between the Marxist-Leninist worldview and the Christian worldview. Well, an invitation like that is a little bit like saying, sick 'em to a dog. You know, I said, well, when do I leave? One of the great things that came about as a result of what turned out to be a number of trips to Russia and Ukraine is that I began to understand, as I never had before, the power to transform lives using the Christian worldview. Now, I've taught the Christian worldview at Western Kentucky University for 27 years. I explained it to my students. I've used the Christian worldview in a number of my books, such as those I've mentioned. But this was my first opportunity to see how worldview thinking and a contrast of the Christian worldview versus Marxism-Leninism would work on the mission field. And let me tell you, I have learned that this is perhaps one of the greatest tools that the church has as its disposal. Worldview thinking can be the foundation of apologetics defending the Christian worldview. It can provide us a new tool for missionary activity. I've got a friend now, president of another Christian college, who's trying to use this in Africa, for example. It can be a great tool in discipleship, in bringing children to Christ. And what I want to do in the little bit of time that I have is I want to deal with three questions out of many that we could ask about worldview thinking in general and about the Christian worldview. And eventually, of course, we're going to work in my text from Romans chapter 10. Question number one, what is a worldview? Here's the answer. It is a person's answers to the most important questions in life. The answers a person gives to the most important questions in life. And I identify five of those questions as the most important. There are many more. The question about God is certainly the most basic. The question about human knowledge, how do we come to know? And can special revelation from God be a part of that knowledge that is made available to us? What about us as human beings? Is there life after death? Do we have freedom, human nature? The question about ethics, questions about ultimate reality. Those are just examples of some of the important questions to which our answers constitute our worldview. Everybody has a worldview. But the problems are these. Not everybody knows that they have a worldview. Very few people know what their worldview is. I remember after giving a message very similar to this before one of my Russian audiences, some dear ladies, graduates of Russian universities, came up and thanked me. And here's what they said. They said, you know, Dr. Nash, before we heard you today, we had no idea what a worldview was. We had no idea what the difference between the Christian worldview and the Marxist-Leninist worldview is. We had no idea that we were naturalists. I'll explain that word a little later. And then they would say, then they said this, I'm not telling you that I'm going to become a Christian today or this week, but I am telling you that for the first time in my life, I'm ready to take a serious look at the Christian faith. Because if nothing else, you have convinced me that the worldview of Marxism and Leninism is full of contradictions and full of problems, and I never knew that before. Question two, what are the two major competing worldviews in the Western world, in the United States? Now, here's where I want you to get your pen out and draw a picture. The first worldview I want to talk about, it's the major competitor. It's the major competitor to the Christian worldview throughout the United States, with the exception of California. Now, I'm going to show you how to draw a diagram that helps you understand the nature of naturalism. But you see, in California, or what we could call the left coast, I can't remember my source for that particular piece of terminology. There are worldviews in California that cannot be drawn, that cannot be illustrated. About the only way you can get the typical California worldview is to take a bowl of oatmeal and throw it against a wall. At least naturalism has the advantage of being something that you can picture, you can visualize, you can think about. Now, let's draw a picture, and whether or not you use a pen or not, let me show you what. You're going to draw a closed box, okay? Do that. You might say amen as you do that. A closed box. Now, that's the worldview of a naturalist. Now, let's add some words to your little picture. Outside the box, write the word nothing. Okay? And inside the box, write, and you can take your choice here, write the word nature, write the physical universe. And what that box illustrates is this. For a naturalist, the only thing that exists is the physical, material universe. Outside of the physical material universe, nothing exists. There is no God. There is nothing else. Now, let me quote a man who may be one of the more famous naturalists of my lifetime, Carl Sagan. He's famous for saying, "The universe is all that is and ever was and ever will be." That's naturalism. Now, let me tell you some other things about naturalism. If a person is a naturalist, he or she has to believe that the box is eternal. Even a naturalist knows that if there was ever a time when nothing existed, his position would be in difficulty. Secondly, a naturalist must be an evolutionist. There is nothing, no intelligence in the universe that guides the development of anything. Therefore, it has to, whatever the world and whatever creatures have developed into, have evolved into, they must have done so as a result of chance, not as a result of design or intelligence. Referring you here intentionally to Bill Dembski's lectures of several weeks ago. Now, we're going to draw a picture of the Christian worldview, okay? Once again, I want you to draw a box. Only this time, you must leave an opening, a window or a door. This is not a sealed box. So here's the window, and then you draw the rest of the box, and then here are some other things to write. First of all, the box itself represents the universe, the created universe in this case, okay? Then outside the box, write the word God, and then draw an arrow from the word God into the box. Now, that diagram can really tell us three important differences between the Christian worldview and the worldview of any naturalist. Now, another word of explanation. Naturalism is manifested in many forms. Marxism-Leninism, the basic philosophy that was taught to all of the audiences that I spoke to, is a form of naturalism. Secular humanism is a form of naturalism. Sheer, unmitigated atheism, and whatever version it might take, that's a form of naturalism. But now, the Christian world, here are three important points. First of all, Christianity believes, in opposition to naturalism, that God exists outside of the box. God exists independently of the universe. He is transcendent. Secondly, and boy, did this get the attention of my Russian audiences. Simple sentence. Difference number two, God created the box. Now, you see, if you're a materialist, if you're a naturalist, to you, everything that's important exists inside that box. Your car. Well, Russians don't have much pride in their cars. And I don't. Listen, I love the Russian people. I met so many marvelous people in Russia. So I'm not. But they make fun of their own cars and their own roads. The typical Russian will tell you there's only two things wrong with Russia: the roads and politicians. And that means part of the Red Army, I would suppose. Okay. God created the box. Everything that is important to you as a Russian, as a Ukrainian, I could argue, depends upon the fact that God created this world. The third point, God acts as a cause inside the box, inside the world. That's the arrow that comes into the box. Now, how does God act causally inside of his universe? Well, through providence, through answered prayer, and especially through miracles. We must recognize that nobody can be a Christian in the biblical sense of the word until they believe in miracles. You want to know why a naturalist doesn't believe in miracles? The answer is he cannot. His worldview will not permit him to believe in miracles. By the time someone who is a naturalist begins to consider even the possibility of miracles, he is on his way to leaving naturalism. Now, there are two miracles in particular that are very important here, and they are the two miracles that are mentioned in Romans chapter 10. And I've got to hurry. If thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus is Lord, and shalt believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. Do you know what those two miracles are? First of all, there is the miracle of the incarnation, and then there is the miracle of the resurrection. People who do not believe in those two miracles are Christians in name only. Now, I've got to hurry here, so I've got to leave some things out. But I want to tell you some information about the naturalist that I mentioned a few minutes ago, Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, as most of you know, became famous. He was a professor at Cornell University because he was given a TV program on public television. And that's when he always began that program with this famous statement, the universe is all it is or ever was, ever will be. A few years ago, I noted somewhere that Carl Sagan had been diagnosed with a terminal disease, a blood disease, something related to leukemia. And in this account that I was reading, Carl Sagan, who was bedridden at home as he awaited death, called his young son over to his bed and put his hand on his son's head. And he said, "Son, I want you to know that I love you." Now, I sometimes come across to people as a hard person with lacking emotion. I began to weep. I began to weep for two reasons. Number one, as a father, I can identify with another father who, in a sense, is saying goodbye to a child. But there's a difference. Carl Sagan thought he was saying goodbye to his son forever. But I also wept because I said to myself, Carl Sagan has committed himself to a worldview in which he cannot consistently tell his son that he loves him. Because the kind of love that Sagan professed for his son is a love that transcends the box. It's agape love. And a naturalist has no right, logically, to use to appeal to the kind of love that God manifested for us on the cross. So a few days later, I was having dinner at an Outback Steakhouse. I wonder if I can get a coupon for saying that on television. Have the switchboard give these people my email address, okay. I was having dinner with another astrophysicist. Carl Sagan's an astrophysicist. The fellow I was having dinner with is named Hugh Ross. And I told him that story, and he said, "You want to know the rest of the story about Carl Sagan?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead, tell me." He said, "Well, you see, we astrophysicists represent a very small community. There are about 30 of us. We all know each other. We're all friends. And a large number of our community is Christian. We're Christians. And we have witnessed to Carl Sagan. And when one of our Christian group heard that Carl Sagan was dying, he sent him this email. Dear Carl, I hear you have a big test coming. I hope you pass it." Now, if some of you don't get the drift of that, ask somebody else before you leave. You understand what we're getting at here. A couple of days later, Carl Sagan sent an email. No one knows this. It's the first time outside of some of my classes where I've told the rest of this story. Carl Sagan sent an email to everybody else in that group, and here was his request. He said, "Please pray for me." Now listen to me. No naturalist prays. When a man says, "Pray for me," he is confessing that his worldview does not meet his needs. He's beginning to look beyond that naturalistic worldview. The man who once said the universe is all it is or ever was or ever will be was saying, "Please pray for me." Now, I don't know how that story ended. Nobody went to visit Sagan. He lived in Ithaca, New York. But I guess since I'm on television, I might just as well look into whatever camera. I guess I'm at that camera right there. And maybe I can just share that message that was shared with Carl Sagan. I understand that you've got a big test coming up, and I hope you pass it. But listen to me. If you're going through life with the wrong worldview, your chances of passing the test I'm talking about are slim and none. So give some consideration to the worldview that you have. Test it. Ask yourself, can I live consistently with this worldview? Is my worldview logically consistent? Does it fit the world outside of me? Does it fit the world inside of me? And maybe it's time that you begin to give serious consideration to the biblical worldview that God has given us in His Scriptures. Let's close in prayer. Our Father, You have done everything for us that we need to be saved, to be forgiven. In the next few days, we commemorate the most important of those events on Good Friday and on Easter, when we remember the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. May Your Spirit work in the hearts and minds